The following programming is sponsored by The Bloor Group. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
You've heard AM. You've heard FM. Now, tune into DM Radio, the world's longest-running show about data. Each week, host Eric Cavanaugh interviews the brightest minds in the world of information management. Want to be on a show? Send an email to info@dmradio.biz. Now, here's your host, Eric Cavanaugh.
Hello and welcome back once again to the longest running show in the world about data. It's called DM Radio. Yours truly, Eric Cavanaugh here. And we're going to talk to several experts today about a pretty hot topic. It really has been the bread and butter of the data industry for a long time now, for decades. We're going to talk about ETL, extract, transform, load, how that is transforming. Quite frankly, it went from ETL to ELT. Many of you may recall that that change in the market, and it was a good change that occurred. Synopsys was a company doing some of that stuff. They got bought by Oracle. But ELT, you kind of reverse things a little bit. So ETL, for those who don't know, stands for extract, transform, load. We use that to pull data out of systems, transform it into a certain schema, and then load it into a data warehouse typically or some target system to be able to do analysis. That all happened largely because we figured out you couldn't do good queries on production systems like ERP systems, like SAP, for example, or PeopleSoft, et cetera. So we decided to pull that stuff out and create a bit of a new architecture. The data warehouse flourished as a result of that. And, you know, I recall back in 2005 when I was really wrapping my head around ETL batch windows and so forth, and I realized why it gets out of hand so quickly. And it's simply because business people realize that they want to use a new data set. They wanted that into the warehouse, so they lobbied and they got their way eventually. And then there were no more batch windows. And so we had to figure out ways to solve that. And, you know, I'll throw out kind of a musing here. I've been talking to some folks from a company called Swim. There's a guy named Chris Sachs, who's the CTO over there. And he was cracking me up the other day, joking about how so many innovations in the data space have wound up being fixes for old architectural decisions. And you could argue that is the case in lots of ways today, in not just the data management world, but in other worlds. But there's something to be said for that. So you can reinvent the wheels and come up with new ways of doing things. Of course, we've come up with data streaming thanks to Kafka, Apache Kafka, which of course came out of LinkedIn, now run by Confluent. But it's a high-powered technology which can add value, but it's not really a replacement for ETL. It can be, depending upon the use case. But even that's not completely real-time, in part because it persists to disk, or at least that's my understanding. So there are lots of these different technologies that come out. Now we have data pipelines, for example, which are a more sophisticated way. And my buddy Philip Russum had a fun comment in the pre-call. He talked about how somebody's data pipelines are leaner and cleaner than ETL, and that is true. And there's this whole observability space that's blowing up all over the place now, which is really quite interesting. And observability primarily refers to being able to tell when something isn't working properly. So you can imagine if you have a data pipeline with 10, 20 different data sources, if one of them goes offline or starts acting wonky, how do you know that? Maybe you get an alert. Well, what if you've got 50 other alerts in your inbox to look at? That'll take some time to get through. So we're always trying to optimize our visibility into whatever the new kind of transformation technology is or integration technology. And you know, that reminds me that observability is really key. And back in the day, in 2010, 2015, when I used to ask questions about this, I'd always wonder, is there any strategic visibility in these big ETL platforms to see really how much data is going where, and are there redundancies? Are there times when we're moving the same data set maybe 2, 3, 4 times a day, and we don't have to do all that? And of course, you have things like change data capture, and there are other ways to kind of solve for these challenges. But as a general rule, we have leaned heavily on ETL and then ELT to pull data into our analytical systems. Data virtualization has been around for a while. We talk about data fabric, data lakes. So all these different concepts are out there. But what does it mean for the actual end users trying to build systems? I'll throw it over to Philip Russum, now independent. Very excited to hear about that. Formerly of TDWI, formerly of Gartner. So, Philip, things are changing pretty quickly out there. It's a bit of a bewildering scenario. What do you think?
Yeah, and it's so true that no matter which nook and cranny we look at in IT, all of IT is evolving like crazy right now. And part of it is one of the big drivers is the move to cloud. As you're moving practically everything in IT to cloud, people have to rethink as they move to cloud, especially in data and analytics where I live. You don't want to just migrate to cloud. You want to re-engineer as you go to cloud.
That's right.
And if you just do the lift and shift and you take your data, take your processes, take your users to cloud, if you're just doing on cloud what you're doing on premises, then where's the improvement to that?
Right.
Also, if you want to get full value out of the power of things like elasticity on cloud, you need to re-engineer for that. You need to re-architect so that you can get the most out of cloud once you're moving there. So, so the adoption of cloud, the fact that it's more than a migration, it's really a re-engineering kind of project. It's forcing changes all the way across the board, everything from in my world, everything from storage at the bottom all the way through to how we're doing BI and reporting. Even that cloud is changing that as we move to cloud.
Yeah, maybe let's get some opening statements from our other guests here real quick, just on what they're seeing, and then we'll kind of dive right in. I'll throw it over first to, Sean Martin from Cambridge Semantics. Tell us a bit about yourself and what you're seeing in terms of the transformation of data integration technologies.
Cool, and thanks for having me on the show, Eric. I appreciate it. So I'm the CTO at Cambridge Semantics. So I'm responsible for our products and where we position ourselves as a knowledge graph platform. And one of the main solutions that we deliver using knowledge graph platform is something Philip just referred to, which is a data fabric. So enterprises that are trying to put their arms around all the data sources, unstructured, structured, semi-structured, external data, internal data, whether it's in the cloud or on-prem or being bought from somebody else. They want to put an overlay over the top of that, and they want to rapidly deliver data products, so combinations of that data for specific business purposes. And to do that, we've created something called a graph mark, which is built on OLAP graph. And so that's where I'm coming from, and I'm very pleased to be here and tell you more about it in due course. Thanks.
Yeah, and I'm a big fan of graph technology, especially for understanding relationships between things. That's where graph really comes into play, it seems to me. And that can help you kind of sort through very complex data environments to figure out what to look at, to figure out where to begin the process of building a meaningful data pipeline, for example. So that's all cool stuff. And Thomas Kratke is from a company called Manta that does very interesting stuff around data lineage. What's the latest with you folks, and how do you see the whole data integration world changing?
I mean, also thanks for having me here. It's really exciting. And hello, everyone. My name is Thomas Kratke. I'm CEO and founder of Manta. Manta is all about visibility for your data pipelines. So when we talk about data lineage, we talk about understanding flow of your data and how your data pipelines are actually built. And for me, visibility is extremely important, especially, in light of all the changes happening in past decade. You just nailed it, because the complexity of our data stack is just really exploding. I mean, we can spend like 60 minutes talking about all the different approaches and technologies we use to process data. And the reason is simply we have a lot of expectations. We want to get amazing stuff from data, and sometimes we need to build complex and difficult data pipelines. And with all that complexity, we believe that visibility is the key how to maintain the environment and how not to, go crazy about all that complexity, how not to spend fortune maintaining the environment. So that's about Manta.
Yeah, well, that's a good overview too. So I'll throw it over to Philip Russum to kind of break this stuff down for us. Complexity can yield tremendous value, but can also yield tremendous frustration, especially when you're trying to troubleshoot something. And that's where this observability stuff really comes in handy, right? Because if you don't have observability and you're trying to find a bug, let's say, in a very complex system, you might be up all night making coffee, getting a little bit frustrated. What do you think, Philip?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think this might be a good moment to sort of talk about automation. In the pre-call, we were here discussing that. And if we think about some of the graph technology that Sean mentioned, a lot of graph technologies will have scanners. Graph databases tend to reach out, go find data. And then the graph, some people call it the data map, Sean, I think you used the term the graph mart, which is a brilliant term. So you basically create a place where you can put those relationships that you mentioned, Eric, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one part of the power of graph. It's like a more usable neural net if you ever work with those things, right? So you can have all kinds of very rich, very complex relationships among data and data elements. And it's funny, you know, in the past, the neural net, now the graph, it's been used for a wide range of things like understanding relationships among your customers, their products, relationships among various people and other human entities and stuff like that. But, you know, that same analytic technology can be turned on your data because no data element lives in isolation, right? They all have some context and that they're, you know, if you just look at a row of a table, that's a lot of data elements and they all have the obvious relationship in that row. But there are a lot of non-obvious relationships that you can only find through scanning, right? Mm. And these relationships can be very complex, especially if you're doing what Tomasz's company at Mantra does, which is to also track lineage of data. You know, where did that data come from? How do we change it as that data traveled, right?
Mm-hmm.
So those kind of things can be worked into sort of the complex relationships represented in graph as well. And so part of it is describing the relationships, but also you don't want to do that manually, mm-hmm. right? It would kill you as a data engineer or some other technical user to be doing that manually. And a lot of data semantics, from metadata to lineage to catalog to the new graph techniques we're using, a lot of that's been done manually in the past. And so we know, as data professionals, we know what a time sink it is.
Mm-hmm.
So automation is really important to get to the point where we can build these complex relationships, right? And also, since the tools are going out and building these, the tools can actually show us relationships we didn't even know about. So we're learning from them, right? And, of course, the relationships change over time. So you need the observability. You need the monitoring side of observability to monitor and track these relationships as they change.
Mm-hmm. And all the different source systems and what's working and what's not working. And I mean, these are all important considerations here. And you're right, the automation. I mean, if you look at the history of automation hitting the warehouse, well, we had the documentation side with companies like Warescape coming along and automating that process. That was pretty useful because show me a developer who loves to document what they work on. There aren't too many of them out there. And in DevOps, we got all excited because the developers were working right with the business people solving problems. But then we kind of forgot about the data side. And I think that's why data ops came around. And around the same time, you have these data pipelines emerging. And of course, the better technology to manage them, to see, I'm going to pull it in from here. I'm going to transform it like this. I'm going to transform it like that. I'm going to fuse, enrich it with this data. Then I'm going to send it out the other side to where it'll be a very useful piece of information now, a very useful nugget. And that's the point, right? Is you're trying to get some useful analysis into the hands of someone on the front lines. Isn't that the whole goal here? Philip.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up documentation because it's funny. Nowadays, DevOps and DataOps, they're pretty much the thing, and there's a lot to learn from those. I'm glad they're with us. But you remember a few years ago when agile development methods found their way into data, one of the first thing we data people learned from the agile methodology is you should never document anything. Because number one, it's documentation is a time sink. Number two, documentation goes out of date very fast.
This is a problem.
As your solutions change, so you can never keep it up to date. Therefore, documentation is a problem. So about 15 years ago, a lot of data tools started working on their automation to document the work of the data engineer as he or she works, right? So actually, automation for generating documentation and keeping it up to date, that's one of the older forms of automation we have with us. But we still need more forms that are more modern. You know, we talked about scanners from graph technology, scanners used with data lineage earlier. We're starting to see analytics techniques like machine learning and artificial intelligence, which were originally designed for, analyzing business entities in the physical world of a business. We're turning those on our data. So, with some tools, we're seeing kind of early functionality for the tool's ability to watch the data engineer work and learn from the data engineer in terms of what the best practices are, right? And also just to do things like mimic e-commerce. You know how you get these recommendations from an e-commerce site?
Yep.
So nowadays, a lot of data management tools for data integration, especially data quality is where I see a lot of this. Those kind of tools can actually recommend certain actions to the developer. For example, you mentioned ETL earlier. Mapping, doing all the complex mappings with ETL is very time consuming. Nowadays, a lot of tools can watch the data engineer working and say, well, in the past, you and other data engineers mapped from that kind of source to this kind of target. So you probably want to do that. And then they'll double back on it and say, well, with that kind of mapping, I've seen you and your team use this combination of transformations or data quality functions, this kind of metadata entry, and so forth. So so you get the idea. There's, I get very excited when I think about the new types of automation coupled with older forms of automation that's really changing the job of the data engineer.
Well, you bring up a really good point here, and to me, it is the value of both automation and AI, too. If you look at what AI does for these systems, it's going to take the form of making recommendations, and that's what you want it to do. You want it to say, hey, do you want to try this or do you want to try that, instead of just deciding for someone, because sometimes you do want to do things differently. But it really does help to get the suggestions. A, the collaborative side of that is big, so you're learning from the other folks in your team, and even from yourself, to your point, even from what you've done in the past. And there's a company, Trifacta, that I think had a lot to do with kind of map watching the behavior of things. And there's a whole industry around that in computer vision and some other cool things happening. But to your point, noticing patterns of behavior and making suggestions, to me, that is tremendously powerful because I can take the suggestion or I cannot take the suggestion. And the automation can even learn from that if it's good AI underneath. Right, Phil?
Yeah, absolutely. And earlier we mentioned the Gartner's definition of the data fabric. And the data fabric brings together really these two strong backbones. It's like a strange creature with two backbones. One backbone is data integration, data pipelining, things that go with it like data quality, master data management, event processing, streaming data, et cetera. The other backbone is really semantics. So that's the three forms of metadata: technical, business, operational, plus the newer stuff like the data lineage that Tomas's company supports, and things like the graph marts and things that Sean's company does. So you put those two together, and you have a lot of functionality. But pulling together all that functionality is part of the Gartner concept of the fabric. But one of the additional requirements is there has to be more automation for everything.
Yeah.
Everything.
Right. That's right.
And, part of it is because the number of data sources is just exploding in a lot of companies. And just automation to help you onboard new sources, that alone is going to save the data engineer help them achieve the kind of productivity numbers they need.
That's a good point. We'll be right back. You're listening to DM Radio.
Do you need to get your hands on some extra money right now? Maybe $25,000 or more? If you're a homeowner, now is the perfect time to get cash out while homes in many neighborhoods like yours have gone up in value. You can use the money for anything. It's yours. You can buy an investment property, pay off higher interest debt, or make home improvements. If you need $25,000, $50,000, or more, now is the time. Home values are up, and so is your equity. We offer you a way to use it. No need to use your savings. Call New American Funding now and see how much cash out you can get. 800-627-6493. 800-627-6493. 800-627-6493. That's 800-627-6493. NMLS 6606. www.nmlsconsumeraccess.org. This is not an offer or commitment to lend. Subject to borrower and property qualifications. Not all borrowers will qualify. Terms and conditions apply. Equal housing opportunity.
Welcome back to DM Radio. Here's your host, Eric Cavanaugh.
All right, folks. Back here on DM Radio, talking with several experts today about modern data pipelines. We're talking to Philip Russom, industry analyst. We've got Tomas Kratky from Manta and also Sean Martin from Cambridge Semantics. It's not Cambridge Analytica, very different company, just so you know. Cambridge Semantics. We heard all about those guys.
Well, thank you for saying that, Eric.
They got into a lot of trouble, didn't they? I'm going to throw this over to Tomas in the break. We were talking about ELT versus ETL. And so what's the difference, right? Extract, transform, load. There are some certain aspects of it that are good. Extract, load, transform. Well, when the cloud is your target destination, it's good because the transform can happen a lot faster. It can be a lot easier up in the cloud, but it also allows you to preserve context. So way back when, we had to do ETL because the pipes were thin, the processors were slow, storage was expensive. Now the pipes are fat, processors are fast, storage is cheap. So all that stuff kind of changed. But Tomas, you had an interesting point about ELT versus ETL and how you don't really like ELT so much. Explain that.
I mean, yeah, I think with the ELT approach, I think it's kind of like excuse for us for being lazy not to do data modeling anymore. I mean, it's so easy to just dump your data to your data lake or data warehouse in cloud and expect someone else will find a way how to make them useful. And it sounded like a great idea originally, but it's not working. I would say there is no single company where it's really working. And you hear a lot of people complaining about it. And the other reason why I don't like this approach so much is, if you think about it, you just copy data and you create dependency on the primary table. So it's very easy to build a system that's very tightly coupled. So you have like a lot of dependencies in your data environment. You usually even don't know about those dependencies. And then when you change something, everything breaks. Especially because there is like no interface in the middle between the consumer and producer. With the old approach, it was not so bad. And I mean, we have like during POCs, when we do the map of the environment, and we have customers complaining like, oh, guys, we don't like the UI. It's just, I mean, it's messy. And we tell them back, like, guys, it's not the UI, it's the pipeline. You don't like the pipeline. So it's, I mean, we can't do anything about that. So, yeah, so that's the reason.
That's pretty funny. That's a good story right there in and of itself. Because it's almost like, you know, when people say, oh, I don't have data quality problems, and then you bring up your database and just show them any random record, you're like, oh, geez, I guess, yeah, you're right. I guess we do have some problems. Seeing is believing, though. I'll throw this over to Sean Martin from Cambridge Semantics. Seeing is believing, and having a way to visualize relationships can really facilitate awareness and understanding of all that, right?
That's certainly true. And I actually think there's a lot to what Tomas has just been saying about the modeling effort and people just thinking, you know, over the last 10 years that we can just dump things into a data lake and it's going to solve our problems, and deferring the issue to somebody else. And actually, that's where we come in, where what I'm doing comes in. We're the somebody else who's been trying to figure out how to undo this mess, right? So, and a big part of that is what Philip was saying, which is using a ton of automation to essentially build the models automatically. So scan the data, build models out of it, and then use the power of a huge OLAP engine to essentially find connections in data. Obviously, you're using any kind of metadata, schema-oriented metadata you can glean to that has been predetermined or maybe is provided by a customer, to tie data together into a graph where everything's connected up. But a lot of the time, you're going to actually need to just use compute to figure out what all the connections are and propose those to your end users. So we're trying very hard in our GraphMod construct, which is, as I mentioned earlier, an overlay technology. So it sits on top of what you've got, including data lakes and you know, application systems and document repositories, etc. All of that, it sits on top, and it essentially ETLs the data out after having built a model from the metadata, first generation model, if you like, and then we use ETL to transform the data again in this graph database to a consumption model, and that's what ends up being the data product. So, and the way we do it, I think, solves quite a lot of the issues that both Philip and Tomas have been talking about. And what the difference, I think, is that the graph engine itself is kind of schemaless. So you can bring in any shape of data, even very dirty data, and fix it through a set of queries. We allow a very iterative kind of agile approach. So we have this system within the graph mod called data layers, where you can keep sort of segments of the graph separate or together, depending on how you want to do it. And those separations allow you to essentially do kind of steps that do the connecting and cleaning of data as discrete elements, so you can keep an eye on what's going on as you do it. But the entire mechanism is really built to tackle these sort of sins of the past, right? Where we've struggled with, because we've got inflexible structures and we've got just a massive amount of problems maintaining integrations of data. So graph solves so many of those problems, and the graph mod is our concept for doing so.
Yeah, no, that's really good stuff. And, you know, Philip, I'll throw this over to you. I'm just kind of wondering about something here. I'm still laughing in my head about your comment about documentation and agile, and don't document anything because it's always going to be out of date by the time someone reads it. I mean, there is something to be said for that. Quite frankly, I can't tell you the number of times I've looked up online to find instructions how to do something. It says, go to the file menu and then find this, and there's no menu there anymore, and something's just gone. So things change, and that's a problem, especially inside large organizations, right? But, you know, it seems to me the one thing that never really ever seems to actually happen is sunsetting some particular system. You know, we think we're going to get there, and the plans are to do that. The cloud strikes me as the one opportunity as we move to a more cloud-centered world, especially with this revelation that data has gravity, and you don't want to be making multiple copies. That's the other hidden dark secret of data in large enterprises, that one piece of data winds up nine places, and then only three of them get updated. And then you got a issue around version control. But I'll throw it over to you, just generally speaking, Philip, is this the time to sunset and to finally re-architect and redesign with cloud as the new center of gravity?
The short answer is yes. And in fact, I do see a lot of organizations finding the resources, the time, the people, the headcount. I see most organizations turning to consultants to help them as they move to cloud.
Right.
And also,
right.
Migration's a bit of a myth. And things like the lift and shift is really a myth. And so if you lift and shift applications, lift and shift data, people, business process, you just lift and shift that to the cloud. There could be some value to that, just to get stuff to a cloud, make your beachhead, get a foot in the door. What you really want to do is re-architect, re-engineer. You want to improve, not
right.
just move. Right.
Right. I like
so,
that.
So now it lift rhymes. And shift might have a place in that. Sometimes it helps to just lift and shift a lot of data to the new cloud platform and start working with it there. That way it helps you learn the new cloud platform. And any optimizations you do to the data to improve the data itself is being optimized for the new platform. So any kind of performance gains and things like that, any remodeling you do, is going to be tweaked for the new platform. And in a lot of ways, that's more compelling than, say, spending too much time cleaning up data and fixing it before you leave the on-premises systems. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, there are old rules we have to break. An old rule in data warehousing was, never let poor quality data into the warehouse. It's just too hard to find it and fix it later and so forth. So we're kind of breaking some of those rules just to get some data onto cloud. But then we have to be diligent. We have to remind people there have to be later phases where we double back and clean up and re-engineer things. And it's like I said earlier, you won't get the full value out of cloud unless you re-engineer for the power of cloud.
Yeah, that's right. Well, refactoring is the term that people use. And there are some companies doing that, and in some of these environments, I think it's a bit easier than in others. I'm just guessing about that. Amazon Web Services, they got a 10-year head start somehow, some way in cloud. And you got, of course, Microsoft has done a great job catching up to them. Google is now serious about trying to catch up with them, but AWS is still a leader, and AWS has all kinds of services that you can use. So you can really cut. In fact, I asked Ali Godsey of Databricks one time, I asked him, if he sees this as a straw in the wind, as the new way of doing things, but instead of building your own functionality, just go into the cloud and cobble together what's already there and use what's proven. And he said, yes, that's exactly what we're doing. I thought that was kind of interesting. What do you think about that real quick, Phil? And then I'll hand it over to the other guest. Phil first. Phil it.
Yeah, you know, I'm pausing because I have my reservations about Amazon Web Services. You know, if we go back in history, Amazon Web Services, it was originally built not for data people like me. It was built for applications developers who were building software as a software architectures. And this atomization of taking a functionality and putting every tiny bit of functionality into a service, it kind of makes sense to the componentized and composable architectures that a lot of these application developers like. But it's kind of alien to us data guys, especially old guys like me with the gray hair. So I think AWS is still the killer application platform for, you know, software as a service. They got there first. They helped to define the whole area, right? But they're doing really well with the data stuff as well. You know, Redshift is their data warehouse platform, and Gartner data shows it's the most popular cloud based data warehouse, purely data warehouse platform out there today. Snowflake and Databricks might catch up with them in the next few years, and don't forget, Microsoft's just getting started, so that number may change. But there's a lot going with AWS, even though it's not quite the approach to development that I'm crazy about.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you know, when you think about data pipelines, to keep this all on track and the subject for today, well, if you're in the cloud, if you've chosen a cloud and it has all the services that you want, well, that solves some of those data pipeline challenges right out of the box, or at least it should. But you are going to have on-prem, you're going to have other places you want to get to. So it's always going to be a little bit complex. But maybe, Tomas, I'll throw this over to you. Just because it's in your wheelhouse, that's where lineage comes into play, right? And understanding where something came from, to vet how good it is for this particular purpose, and to be able to build access layers to the data you want that are reliable and that are fast, right, Tomas?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I just to answer it and not spend like 50 minutes talking about it, like what we see is that I don't believe in like one platform being a winner here, especially for larger organizations. Mm-hmm. I see all of them using multiple solutions. And I mean, I'm still like not so experienced as you guys, only like 25 years in business, but I already saw like five cycles when we have something new, we believe it's going to win. And then after a couple of years, you see like five, six, seven other solutions being like better and being used by specific teams and in specific departments for specific use cases. There's like always something new, and we try to embrace it. And that's also part of the complexity. In this case specifically, like Amazon was the first, and we see a lot of Glue on top of Redshift, but it's usually like just one part of the pipeline. We as engineers, we tend to focus on the data processing piece, but that's actually a small part of the pipeline. We completely forgot about the upstream part with like services and integrations and applications. And then the analytics piece, just look at most organizations, the analytics piece, like the calculations we do there and transformations we do there, just, I mean, in Alteryx or in Tableau or Looker or Cognos, whatever. It's like, I mean, 50% of the pipeline. So if you want to understand how you move your data and how, like what calculations you do with data, like this piece of the pipeline is equally important to your ETL or ELT. So from my perspective, that's the value of lineage, just to show it end to end, just give you the map so you fully understand what do you do with your data. Yes, exactly.
Good call, yeah. I'm reminding myself of something funny I heard a couple of weeks ago. A guy on the show joked that ETL is the most popular data integration tool he sees these days. What he meant by that is people are using Tableau to just view the data, and that's their ETL. And like, no, that's just your little view of the world now. That's not the view of the world of what's really happening out there. But this is the point that you're trying to make here, right, Tomas, is that whole second half is really kind of important, and you want to be as close to the core of the information. I mean, this is the Snowflake story. I came from the Snowflake Summit a few weeks ago, and you know, now they're talking about bringing the code to Snowflake. So actually building your applications in store, the Unistore, I think is what they're calling
it. Yes.
Building your applications inside, which is interesting. It's like, okay, well, that does, you know, make sense for certain use cases when the performance will be a lot better if you go that particular route. But when I thought to myself, as just a standard business user, wait, can I just do that in Azure with Mongo and whatever else I want? And the short answer is yes, you certainly can. But the question is, what is the impact of that going to be? Do you really need to have data of this caliber for that particular application in this particular scenario? And if the answer is yes, then yeah, do it that way. But we'll pick this up after the break, folks. Lots of interesting considerations. We'll be right back. You are listening to DM Radio.
In times of economic uncertainty and chaos, your money means nothing. You may not even be able to get it from your bank or ATM. And the money you do have in the stock market will go down and down. What you can bank on is gold and silver. Gold and silver have been a reliable and trusted form of currency for thousands of years. Gold and silver have never been worth zero, and typically gold holds its value during economic turmoil. Call the Gold Hotline now and learn how to protect your money and your assets with gold and silver. And learn how to set up a new IRA or roll over your current one into a gold-backed IRA. Protect your money from the next market crash with gold and silver. Call now for your free gold guide.
800-755-4281. 800-755-4281. 800-755-4281. That's 800-755-4281.
If you're trying to quit drinking or doing too many drugs, listen to me. You don't know me and we'll never meet. I had a problem like you once. I drank and used to party a little too much till it got out of control and almost ruined my life. I realized I needed help to fix my problem before it totally destroyed me. If you've tried to fix your drinking and drug problem and you know you can't do it alone, you need to call the National Treatment Advisors. They'll immerse you into a 30-day program to replace your old habits with new habits and totally change your life. And if you have PPO private health insurance, the entire program may be covered. Fix your problem right now before it gets any worse. Get clean. Call now and learn more. 877-247-1585. 877-247-1585. 877-247-1585.
Welcome back to DM Radio. Here's your host, Eric Cavanaugh.
All right, folks. Back here on a very lively show today on DM Radio. We're talking all things ETL, really data pipelines. And semantics are a big part of data pipelines. We were just using in the break there, Tomasz Kratky from Manta was talking about the importance of getting things right. You know, one of my favorite cliches, Tomasz, is well begun is half done. And the point being, nice. If you really think through what you're trying to accomplish and get set off on the right foot, you're going to be all right. Because, man, here's a great example of these analogies. It's like when you're doing highway driving and you get on the highway going the wrong direction and you got to go another 10 miles before you can even turn around to make up that 10 miles. And then the 10 miles you also went before you realized you're in the wrong direction. Oh, my goodness. It is so depressing when you're going cross country and you're like, oh, you're exhausted. You had 2 hours. Now you have 2 hours and 40 minutes. When it's going in the wrong direction. That's a morale killer. What do you think, Tomasz?
I know that feeling. Just being new to United States, I had to learn a lot about driving. But talking about data pipelines, I think we have the very same issues on a daily basis. And I see it quite often. We build data pipelines in a way that I would say it's not to the high standards we could potentially learn from software engineering buddies we have. And the whole idea of like observability and monitoring, it's like very, very useful, but we should also think how to move quality to the left. So when I am building my data pipeline, I should ask myself like why I am building it. And that's where semantics is so important and data contracts and understanding data I need. And the second part of the story is how to build it right. So how to do proper design, and we are back to modeling, how to do proper quality assurance, meaning like how to ensure that when I like commit the code to the repository, I'm not going to break something. Mm-hmm. And I should know that we have tools, like Manta is one of them. You have tools in place how to know that you are not going to break something by your commits or changes in the code. And I think this is really critical, and we just try to I mean, what it's like with ELT, like we just dump data and hope for the best. We should stop doing this. It's not the right way.
That's funny. And I'm like a perfectionist. I've got an OCD left and right. So that kind of stuff drives me nuts. Like the little alerts on your phone that there are messages. I'm like, make it go away. I can't stand looking at that stuff. But semantics is a great segue, obviously, over to Sean Martin from Cambridge Semantics. And you even alluded to this earlier, that you're really kind of understanding the relationships between records, for example, really columns, identities, you know, entities in your environment. That's pretty important for knowing what to work on. So you can then do the next step, which is what Tomas is talking about, of really building a good, robust data pipeline where quality is paramount from the outset. Right, Sean?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, everybody knows who's developing products, the later in the cycle that you actually catch the bug, the more expensive it is, right? So if you can catch it where your engineer is writing the code or your data engineer is able to fix that quality issue, compared to when your end user reports it and the expense of all the communication needed to communicate that there's a problem and then backtrack to figure out where it actually happened, it's just almost exponential. So you as far as possible do want to catch things as early as possible, but at the same time I think we're also looking for technologies, and that's what we've been trying to do, technologies that give you a kind of a flexibility to be able to change your mind further and further, or rather closer and closer to the consumer of the data. So understanding of data and provenance indeed is vital. In fact, projecting provenance into the user experience is something we're getting asked for more and more. And I wonder if automated provenance is actually that form of automated documentation. It's for 2022. But we are, well, you know, the name of the company is Cambridge Semantics. So the semantic models that we use to describe the data and the metadata in the language of the business is really important, so that by the time and we do that as early as possible in the pipeline, and then one of the wonderful things about the technology we're using is that the data description travels with the data through our pipeline. So through all the transformations and so on, we have the context and the meaning of the data so that we can then project that right into the end user tools, and users can actually understand what they're seeing because it's described in the language of their business. So, semantics is very important. Provenance is increasingly important, not just for the data engineering, but for the end user to have trust in the data, actually. And from what we're trying to do really is trying to provide this flexibility to be able to adjust things much later so that you can deal with unanticipated questions. ETL was really about building structures for anticipated questions.
Right. And that's a good point.
Graph is all about, at least some graph that we use for knowledge data integration is all about dealing with unanticipated questions, because you can essentially slurp up all the data, connect it up, come up with models for easier consumption that are more meaningful to end users, but also then very quickly bring in new sources of data and connect, just one relationship to this new piece of data makes that part of the graph too. And so your questions can be more far ranging and not have been the ones that you actually built the data system for necessarily. And that's a huge, huge value to our customers. Being able to answer the unanticipated questions on the fly is key.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And that's what used to plague data warehouses, because Philip Russum, you really had to think about the questions that were going to be asked so you could prepare for that. Even when you're fine-tuning the database and doing OLAP cubes and so forth, you really had to know what people were going to ask. Well, that's not a very useful thing when there are new questions that come up in your mind. And I will say one clever thing I thought, as I recall, at the beginning of Snowflake's launch, way back like 9 years ago or so, is they figured out, we'll allow companies to take down a warehouse and then spin it back up very quickly so you can make changes to your schema and then spin that thing right back up. So they saw that, and I think they fixed it from that perspective. But, what are your thoughts about giving yourself more latitude going down the line? There was a late-breaking question from an attendee about, are there any next-generation ETL tools? So those two questions for you in 2 minutes and 30 seconds. Go.
So, I've been in and out of data warehousing for 35 years. So the whole spin down and spin up thing, a lot of data warehouses are built as many components. And part of that, so you can spin down certain pieces of the warehouse without shutting down the whole warehouse. So I'm not sure that was such an urgent thing. And Eric, I'm sorry, but I'm going to change the subject because I want to hit some stuff we didn't cover today.
Okay.
Important things we didn't cover. I'm going to go back to Sean Martin for a minute, and he was talking about the graph marts and this sort of thing. You know, Sean, one of the things that we see in data warehousing for years, regularly, business people will come to the data warehouse team and say, look, before I make a really important decision based on the data in this report or this dashboard, et cetera, you need to tell me again, where did you get it and what did you do to that data? And Sean, if you've got a graph mart or you have a data catalog or something similar, Tomas, if we have data lineage well documented, then with any luck, those users can actually answer that question on their own instead of turning it all into a fire drill for the data engineer. See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So it may sound like one simple use case, but that use case shows up a lot. And this kind of, modern semantics will help people have greater trust before they make their decisions, greater observability and so on and so forth. Another thing we didn't get a chance to talk about today is design practices for data pipelines are still emerging, right? And we don't want to turn the pipeline into just another ETL job, right? We don't want to do that. We want to think differently. So we do. One school of thought says the data pipeline should, by its nature, be as simple as possible, be lean and clean, like we said early on here, let's have as few. If we can make it from server memory to server memory, to keep it simple, let's not be landing data to disk because that just takes time, and you have to model what goes on the disk, et cetera. So that's one school of thought is for the really simple data pipeline. But there's another school of thought emerging.
Yeah, go ahead.
Which is that we're going to build more complex data pipelines that bring together many different data disciplines in one more complex pipeline. And if you build the kind of fabric that we've been talking about today with a lot of tool types, you could do that. So just keep it in mind that the pipeline, it's with us, but a lot of its best practices are still emerging.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I'll get back to observability as a final comment, that the more you can see, the more you can understand how long it's taking, how troublesome it is, how problematic it is. What is the cost of all this stuff? You saw, again, not to keep mentioning Snowflake, but it's fresh in my mind, they talk about resource groups, which is an attempt on their part to be able to manage the costs of these things. I'm not sure exactly how it works or how accurate it would be, but knowing what is going to be the bill, you know, what was the one big joke I heard about AWS a few years ago? It's the most ungoverned line in your IT spend bill is AWS because you just don't know what it's going to cost because something spiked and you didn't have the right alert in place, or you did and someone didn't notice it, and someone was worried about breaking something. I mean, all these are considerations, but folks, send me an email if you want to be in the show, info@dmradio.biz. Big thanks to all of our guests today. You have been listening to DM.
Do you need to get your hands on some extra money right now? Maybe $25,000 or more? If you're a homeowner, now is a perfect time to get cash out while homes in many neighborhoods like yours have gone up in value. You can use the money for anything. It's yours. You can buy an investment property, pay off higher interest debt, or make home improvements. If you need $25,000, $50,000, or more, now is the time. Home values are up, and so is your equity. We offer you a way to use it. No need to use your savings. Call New American Funding now and see how much cash out you can get. 800-627-6493. 800-627-6493. 800-627-6493. That's 800-627-6493. NMLS 6606. www.nmlsconsumeraccess.org. This is not an offer or commitment to lend. Subject to borrower and property qualifications. Not all borrowers will qualify. Terms and conditions apply. Equal housing opportunity.
In times of economic uncertainty and chaos, your money means nothing. You may not even be able to get it from your bank or ATM. And the money you do have in the stock market will go down and down. What you can bank on is gold and silver. Gold and silver have been a reliable and trusted form of currency for thousands of years. Gold and silver have never been worth zero, and typically gold holds its value during economic turmoil. Call the Gold Hotline now and learn how to protect your money and your assets with gold and silver. And learn how to set up a new IRA or roll over your current one into a gold-backed IRA. Protect your money from the next market crash with gold and silver. Call now for your free gold guide.
800-755-4281. 800-755-4281. 800-755-4281. That's 800-755-4281.
If you're trying to quit drinking or doing too many drugs, listen to me. You don't know me and we'll never meet. I had a problem like you once. I drank and used to party a little too much till it got out of control and almost ruined my life. I realized I needed help to fix my problem before it totally destroyed me. If you've tried to fix your drinking and drug problem and you know you can't do it alone, you need to call the National Treatment Advisors. They'll immerse you into a 30-day program to replace your old habits with new habits and totally change your life. And if you have PPO private health insurance, the entire program may be covered. Fix your problem right now before it gets any worse. Get clean. Call now and learn more. 877-247-1585. 877-247-1585. 877-247-1585.